good afternoon. I think we'll try and head off on time, so we've got plenty of time for questions at the end. So Ross is a Senior Research Fellow at the Insurance Work and Health Group at Monash Uni. He has a physio and a PhD degree from La Trobe and postgrad a diploma in work disability prevention studies from the University of Sherbrooke in Canada. Prior to joining the IWH group, he taught physiotherapy and research skills to university students for over 10 years. Ross's particular research interests focus on methods of identifying individuals at risk of long-term disability and has led projects in New South Wales and Queensland related to the development and implementation of methods to enable early and appropriate intervention. His approach to research focuses on developing a partnership to understand not only the questions to be solved, but also to identify solutions that best fit with the demands of all stakeholders involved. So thank you, Ross.
Thank you very much. And it's great to have this opportunity to share with you some of the work we've been doing, in this case with EML and the PACE project. So I'll tell you about the PACE protocol. So PACE stands for the Plan of Action for a Case, just with some creative acronym generation in the last bit there. Thanks very much, Karen, as co-author, and a colleague, Cameron Gosling, also at Monash University. So I thought, in terms of the presentation, it's always good to set some context, and then I'll tell you a little bit about how we developed the tool, and then the application. And so what we know from the project so far, we're halfway through our analysis of the outcomes, and then a little bit about the next step of the analysis and what the project will actually show us at the end. So in terms of setting the context, so it was mentioned earlier today about predictive analysis and being able to provide insights and setting up data systems that can capture, and I learnt a new word, and I've forgotten it already, about being able to integrate the data in real time. When it comes to the research around prediction of disability, there's a lot of work in the exploratory phases. So a lot of work's been done in terms of identifying what things could possibly predict the outcome. And we certainly know from analysis of administrative data, the data that's usually sitting in workers' compensation databases, is that we can actually make some pretty complex equations and predictive models that will actually get us most of the way there to helping to identify people who might be at higher risk of a poor outcome. And so there's lots of research in this exploratory area and developing multivariate models, but what you need to be able to do is turn that exploratory research into real-world impact. How do you turn that theoretical knowledge into results on the ground? And that's where we actually start to see this inverted triangle taper off, where there has been quite a few validation of a number of models and tools that can be used. But when it comes to confirmation of impact, when we did a review of the published literature, we came across around about 8,000 different studies, and we actually found one that demonstrated true impact of screening and then intervening based on that intervention. So there's 8,000 potentials at the top. We got down to one published example of this is a screening and intervention process that actually can show you results, not whether it works, whether it actually shows results or not. And so it's worth pointing out what those examples, what that example might be, and that's the StartBack tool. So the StartBack was a short screening tool applied purely for low back pain in primary care in the UK. And so it's not applied in a workers' compensation context where we know, unfortunately, outcomes are typically worse in the compensation sector compared to people who aren't undergoing compensation. But what is positive about it is that actually intervening based on a risk profile, so providing different interventions based on the risk profile that was identified, actually got better results, and it was cost effective. We have a local example, the WISE study, which I haven't seen published results just yet, but on the grapevine the results are very positive from the WISE approach in terms of screening for a risk of psychosocial or psychological complications, and actually having people on the ground performing assessments early on and helping people getting psychological intervention early, and has led to a positive outcome so far. And both of those examples are actually targeted to a specific area, if you like, low back pain or psychological injury. So what we're hoping to provide for you is another local example. That's the plan of action for a case, the PACE project, where we actually are applying a screening tool and intervening based on the risk profiles that are identified by the screening tool. And when I say intervening, we're giving case managers the tools to put in place the most appropriate or best practice case management intervention within 2 weeks of onset or 2 weeks of receipt of the claim. So how do we develop the PACE tool? Well, we use three key sources. So we reviewed all of that literature that we're talking about in terms of the potential factors that could influence the outcome of a claim. We spent a lot of time with the EML case managers, team leaders, and return to work specialists to identify from the people who are going to be using the tool, what do they need? And as it turns out, when we're speaking to case managers, they actually identify a lot of the things that pop up in the literature. It's just they don't necessarily have good systems to record them and be able to draw on that information later. And then we actually had a sample of existing claims data to be able to identify if there are any differences in the context we were going to be working with that we might need to incorporate into the tool. So using these three sources of information, we came up with the PACE tool. And there are a total of 43 different questions in the PACE tool, and I'll run through them really quickly, but some of them are pretty obvious as to whether an interpreter is required. Whether the person had a previous or a current claim, it's pretty clear that if someone's already had a claim, that their risk goes up. The Erebro short form. So the Erebro short form is a questionnaire consisting of 10 questions aimed to identify the need for further psychological assessment. And that it was the Erebro short form that was applied in the WISE study. So we aim to apply the same protocol that was applied in the WISE study, but in that case manager context. We asked people about their confidence that they'd actually be able to return to all of their usual duties in 1 month's time. We also asked them that same question, but changed the time frame. How certain are you'll be able to return in 3 months' time? We asked about job satisfaction. We asked if the worker had any concerns about going back to work, just a very general question. We asked some questions related to workplace conflict that corresponded with the Safe Work Australia survey. We also asked questions about whether the injured worker felt they had enough support at home or in the workplace to help them recover. And then if they had any problems actually coping with the day-to-day activities as a result of their injury. And so we group those together as worker-related risks. Then in terms of employer-related risks, we know that smaller employers might actually find it more difficult to be able to provide suitable duties, might not have in place significant structures to assist with return to work like large employers might. And we needed to identify whether suitable duties were currently available or not. But then also we asked the employer, were there any issues around the worker's performance? Because that could actually potentially be a key barrier in return to work. So had the worker had any problems in the past? We also asked the employer for their expectation of recovery. When did they expect that worker to be back? Or what were the chances they expect that worker to be back at work in a month or in 3 months' time? And then we also asked a very important question, have they actually had contact with the injured worker? Then we have a whole category of risks related to the treater or the injury itself. And so this is where we incorporate information around the injury type. We know certain injuries are higher risk. We wanted to know about the treatment so far and has it actually been return to work focused? Is there a plan in place? Was the claim lodged within a reasonable time frame? We know that delayed claiming is a risk factor. The diagnosis, and then we have some aspects around the certificate. So has the person been certified completely unfit? and had they been certified completely unfit for greater than 2 weeks? Now, we know that in some circumstances that's actually an appropriate certification, but there are a number of circumstances where that's not. And then we have a number of items where we actually get the case manager to actually look at the information they've received so far and work out, does it match up? So does the certificate match up with the diagnosis? So if it's a simple cut, does that line up with being off work unfit for 2 weeks? And then how has the communication been between the stakeholders, and are there differences in expectations? Because if the worker's expecting to be back at work tomorrow but the employer's not expecting them back for a couple of months, there might be something you need to address between that communication to actually make sure everyone's on the same page. Now, this information was completed over the first 2 weeks of a claim, gathering information from the worker, information from the employer, and then gathering information from the treaters. Usually, in this situation, usually it's from the documentation that was coming in. And we labelled these risks ready. Is the worker ready to go back to work? Set. Is the employer set for the worker to come back? And then have they been cleared to go back to work? To come up with our model of ready, set, go, to identify the different risks that might be present in a claim. In terms of the interventions that were available to the case managers, they had the option of referring to mobile case management, so get to be have someone face-to-face to address a number of those risks. There's the option to refer to a psychologist, an external intervention at the workplace, case conference between key stakeholders, and then what we called skilled conversations, which was an opportunity for the case manager to actually have a detailed conversation with a particular stakeholder that had a particular goal in mind. So that might be a conversation with the worker to identify why do they have low recovery expectations, why are they thinking it's going to take them a little while to recover, or speaking with the doctor in terms of that education component. We know case managers often have to do with GPs around certifying for return to work. And we labelled that as a skilled conversation, as a means of giving the case manager permission to take the time to find out that further information. And each of the risks that we identified linked to those different pathways. And I'll give you some examples of how that happened later down the track. So in terms of what we did, we actually had... I've broken my pointer... We had project teams in different sites within EML and that were matched for the types of claims that were coming in. And they were geographically distinct groups, and we'll get back to that later as to why that might be important. But liability was accepted, and the person hadn't actually returned to work within, or pre-injury duties within 5 days. And we excluded catastrophic injuries. So over the time frame of the project, 3,172 claims were allocated to those PACE teams. We have 559 complete PACE data sets. And I refer there to an intervention group and a control group. So the intervention group actually received a recommended intervention pathway that they should follow based on that completed information. Whereas the control group still completed all the information, but it was up to case manager discretion as to what to do next. They still had the same interventions available to them, but whether they initiated them was completely up to the case manager's own judgment. And you can see there's a big difference between 3,172 and 560. The number one reason for why there's a big difference there is that most people actually return to work within 2 weeks. So we weren't going to actually call them up and ask them questions when they'd actually returned to their pre-injury duties. A number of claims were actually notification-only claims. There were a proportion that we didn't actually manage to capture in that time frame. So I made a very important change to my slides this morning. In one place, I called him Michael, and here his name is Anthony. So let's call him Michael Anthony. So just as an example of how the tool might operate. So Michael Anthony's had a shoulder injury at work, but in the background, there's some things grumbling along. He's been putting up with the injury for a while. He's quite anxious. We're sure all aware there are a million reasons why there could be something underlying or pre-existing in the background that's really exacerbated by an injury at work. So in terms of what could be identified with the PACE screening, that Michael Anthony has low recovery expectations. And for us, that was a score of less than 8 out of 10 in terms of 0, I'm not confident I'm going to be back in a month, and 10, I'm definitely going to be back in a month. So 7 and below. And he also scored highly on the Erebro short form questionnaire. So in this case, a score of 50 or over. In the possible recommended interventions for this case were a skilled conversation. So in terms of having a conversation with Michael Anthony about why do you think it's going to take you a little bit longer than a month to get back to your pre-injury duties? What are some of the reasons? What are you thinking? And then in terms of the high score on the short form Erebro, well, following the WISE protocol, that would actually trigger a referral to a psychologist to actually, that indicates that there is something going on that actually needs a skilled intervention. So in the intervention group, they would have been recommended that treatment pathway, whereas in the control group, still had that same information available to them, but it was up to the case manager in terms of what they actually did to help manage this claim. And so let's have a look at the prevalence of these risk factors, because we have a lot of information on the administrative level data that we capture easily. But some of these, particularly psychosocial factors, we don't actually have a lot of information on how prevalent they are in a set of claims. So in our sample, 45% of completed PACE claims, people had low recovery expectations. And low recovery expectations is something that pops up continuously in the predictive literature as a sign that the person's at risk of poor outcomes. Not surprisingly, when you ask people the same question further down the track, they weren't as negative. Only 21% thereabouts had low recovery expectations, so that's less than 8 out of 10 that they'll be back to their pre-injury duties. And this is the spread of our Erebro scores. I feel like I need to stand over here. This is the spread of our Erebro scores that we captured through the study. And the red arrow indicates the established cut point for high risk for the short form Erebro. And so you can see we've got a bit of a bell-shaped curve, and where this intervention marker as this person's high risk falls is bang on, is at 50. It may be that a more suitable cutoff might be elsewhere. And that's one of the things, now that we've got this information, we can actually investigate. But what is really quite interesting is the total number of these high risk flags in terms of if people accumulated. So majority of claims didn't have any of these ready risk factors. But then you can see, in terms of accumulating those different risks, we only had a very small proportion with high numbers. What that indicates to me is hopefully the different risks that we're measuring in that ready risk set are different. We're not capturing the same risk over and over again. And we'll actually, part of our analysis is to identify, are there particular risks or groups of risks or even numbers? Should we be really worried if we're in the 2 or 3 range? And that's one of the questions we'll be able to answer. How am I going for time, Karen?
You've still got 10.
Okay, good. Okay, Bruce. Let's call him Bruce. Bruce. Bruce works as a delivery driver. So in this case, he's in a smaller company, and he has a workplace injury that is going to be some challenges around whether he can actually whether there'll actually be suitable duties available for him. So in terms of the PACE risk factors, it can be identified that the employer was actually unable to provide suitable duties, because Bruce is the kind of guy that sort of does a little bit of everything. There's no return to work coordinator in the workplace, and the employer is not actually confident in actually developing a suitable duties plan. And in this case, the recommended intervention would be mobile case management. So actually get a case manager out to the workplace and have a chat to the employer to actually have a look at what duties might be available. In the situation where mobile case management's not available in that area, there's the option to have a third party provider go into the workplace and do that assessment, recommend suitable duties or not. And again, in the intervention group, that was recommended to the case managers that would be the appropriate intervention. Whereas for the control group, those options were available to them, but it was up to the case manager's discretion to actually put those things in place. So in a similar manner, we'll have a look at how prevalent these factors were. So in almost 15% of cases, the employer was unable to provide suitable duties, and that was identified in talking to the employer. And that's meant to be a return to work coordinator. So around about 45% of situations are where there are issues with not having someone skilled in the workplace to actually assist with that suitable duties progressing back to work plan. And so it's just a graph of that information. So suitable duties are not available, but here we can see that it's around having people in the workplace who are actually able to assist with the process. And that indicates a higher risk for those set factors. And again, if we have a look at the accumulation of those set risk factors, most people had at least one risk related to their employer in the employment category. We do see a sort of a real bunch around the 1 to 4 numbers of employer-related risks. And then we start to see the drop-off happening down here. And that's possible because a number of these risks are similar. If you're a small employer, you're not likely to have suitable duties, you're not likely to have a return to work coordinator. And we'll look further into the numbers to see if we can actually group these aspects as a single risk factor than individual risk factors. Now, case 3, Emma, she injured her back at work. Things were a bit busy, so she was helping out when she normally wouldn't. She's now struggling, but Emma's been seeing her same doctor for years and years and years, which suggests that perhaps her doctor has been around for years and years and years, and probably it might go down the road of actually certifying, well, you need 2 weeks rest, complete rest off work, simply because you've got some back trouble. And so some of these risk factors identified, they've been certified unfit for more than 2 weeks is a risk factor. If the doctor says, well, you need to take 3 weeks off work. There's been no upgrade in the certificate in the 2 weeks, so there hasn't been any change, so that would be a risk that this person's not actually getting better. And then the recommended intervention would be a skilled conversation to actually identify with the GP, if possible, to identify what are some of the reasons behind. Is it appropriate to certify for no capacity? Does Emma genuinely not have capacity? And if necessary, go down the route of actually having a case conference with that GP and potentially the employer to identify if there are suitable duties that she can perform safely. And again, these interventions were recommended to the intervention group, and the control group still had all that information gathered, but then it was up to the case manager to decide what to do with it. So to be certified as unfit for any duties for more than 2 weeks occurred in over 50% of cases. That's pretty significant number of people who have been certified as having zero capacity for any work for more than 2 weeks. And there was no upgrade in the status in the first 2 weeks of the claim for 31.7%. So over half of people have been certified as unfit for a long time, and then around about a third are actually not progressing in that first 2 weeks of a claim. So we already know they're at high risk, and the number that was thrown around this morning was 21 days. So we're actually getting awfully close to that 21 days just with these two numbers. So that indicates that we're at risk here. And what I've put on this slide is the particular injury types and the high-risk categories that they fall into. So the blue bar here is whether they're being certified as greater than 2 weeks being unfit. The orange bar is that there hasn't been an upgrade in the period of data collection. The bar that's missing here on this one is that they're actually still unfit, and there's no confirmed diagnosis. So these are the different injury types that have been that were flagged as high risk, and they're the reasons for why they were high risk. And you can see with psychological injuries that there are flags going off all over the place. And that may well be appropriate for psychological injuries. But if we have a look at the, again, that cumulative risk factor, 5 minutes, thank you, the accumulation of those risk factors, well, in this go factor, no one had zero risk factors. But we see a big jump between one and two, and then we see the same pattern we saw happening elsewhere. So what we'll be investigating is this jump important, or is it possible that we really just say that, well, between one and two, that's the trigger point or not? And so just to put everything together, I know this slide's very busy, but across the different risk categories, there are a couple in each category that are much more prevalent than the others. And sometimes these are the things that pop out as people thinking that they're really, really important in the progress of a claim. So, for example, these are our measures of conflict within the workplace. And they're only around for around about 6% of the claims. The things like this worker having contact with the employer, and this is the not having contact, it's only actually really, really small. That doesn't mean it's not important. It's just not happening very often, at least captured in our data. So it's actually important to get an idea of these spreads. What I do like seeing here, though, is these aspects. So this here is whether there's a return to work coordinator or there are suitable duties planning in place. They're things that case managers can address really quite easily, effectively, or within their current remit, probably a way to think of that. Same with recovery expectations and that their activities of daily living have been impacted. You can actually have a discussion with the person about their expectations for return to work. There's that whole education component we know that case managers can do so well about that getting back to work is part of recovery. And then the worker ADLs are impacted. Well, there are services that case managers can actually put in place to help with that. So I kind of like seeing that. And then in terms of certification, well, it was mentioned earlier that do we need to be educating GPs? And that's one of the challenges when certifying is only a very small part of what GPs do. And but we can certainly have an education role in helping them, at least helping them identify that there are suitable duties available in the workplace. And this is the combination of all the risk factors across the tool. So we had a very small number getting up into sort of 15 to 20 risk factors, whereas we've got a real group sort of in this area that actually have multiple risk factors. Not many who don't have much going on, but a number that actually have quite a bit going on. And what we'll be taking plenty of time with our analysis is to actually be able to unpack what's going on with these. And are there key patterns of these risks that actually indicate that someone's at high risk? So what the PACE project will tell us. So does it actually help us identify high-risk claims? And when we say high-risk claims, our outcomes we'll be looking at are return to work rates and costs of claims. What are the key combinations of risk factors to look for? So you might notice that some of the usual suspects in risk factors weren't present in the PACE tool, for example, gender and age. And a key reason for that is that they're non-modifiable risk factors. So we're looking at what key combinations of risk factors can we look for with an eye for case managers to intervene. And then, does the suggested intervention pathway actually lead to improved outcomes? And we'll be comparing the practices between the control group and the intervention groups to see if, to determine, was there a significant difference in how they managed a claim as far as possible. So watch this space. So we're in the process of actually sorting through the data. It's early next year is when we'll have results ready to tell everyone about, and we're very excited about telling everyone about it. But this is the very pointy end of that triangle that we talked about before. So this is actually applying it within workers' compensation context across multiple injury types, and it's in a workers' compensation insurer, which is a large organisation. There are multiple things going on within a large organisation, and we have actually managed to capture a significant amount of data to actually help us to identify what risks are the most important to capture in a claim, and how can we intervene to improve them. And I could talk about this all day, so I better stop there.
Thank you. Are there any questions from people? Jenny Johnson.
Daniel Keating, just in the spirit of your opening slides, are you committing to presenting at a subsequent seminar or forum on the outcomes?
Absolutely. Yeah, once that's the whole thing of we've got to get it out there. I think a lot of the there's a lot of, and we've done a project actually gathering industry intelligence around this area, and there's a lot of corporate knowledge around that's not necessarily in that academic space. I mean, I'm a researcher, so that's the space I live in, so that's where I go to first to look for that information. But absolutely, and one of the key reasons that EML actually engaged with Monash University is to provide a level of rigour to ensure that results are published regardless of the findings. So we're not interested in just publishing to show that it's amazing. It will be, this is what we did and this is what we found.
G'day, Hugh Miller. Firstly, congrats on a great study design. It's very exciting.
Thank you.
My question was sort of, you may have mentioned it, I missed it, how you developed the PACE recommendations, so the treatment group compared to the control.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess relatedly, whether you've done any work already on how those recommendations deviated from what the case managers were doing themselves anyway.
Yeah. So the two parts there. The first one was we looked at the interventions we had available to us, so we actually used that as almost an anchor point. And there were some areas where we felt we weren't able to intervene. We developed, there was a mediation intervention developed for, I guess, severe workplace issues. Wasn't actually utilised throughout the project, but we went through and linked what is available to the case managers, what is the case manager skill set, and linked the different risk factors from the tool, or use that as the process to decide what goes into the tool, and then develop the pathways in terms of setting in place, for example, a review point or what it might be based on those profiles. The second question of did what they were supposed to do actually happen? That's a key part of the analysis, and we actually have one aspect of the tool that I haven't dived into is actually the information technology part that actually captured all this information along the way that actually enabled us to capture what interventions were enacted and how it worked. So it was a very much an operational tool that enabled case managers to not only receive the recommendations but actually record when things had happened. We had a fantastic on-the-ground project team actually monitoring that and making sure that everything was recorded.
Do you want to just mention the intervention and control groups and the separation
geographically? Yeah. So what's really important is the two sites are actually geographically separate for the intervention and control groups. So one's based in Newcastle, one's based in Gosford. So intervention was in Gosford, controls in Newcastle. So it avoids that contamination effect of, sorry, I'm talking like a researcher, that case managers could be chatting to each other and actually, be masking some of the effect of actually telling them this is the intervention you should apply. And so it's actually one of the strengths of the study design will actually be that they're geographically separate. We tried as hard as we could to actually match the nature of claims going into the two sites as closely as possible, and our early analysis shows that they're pretty similar, bunch of claims going in and out. But a real challenge to get the control groups to actually ask all the questions because they didn't necessarily see that, okay, I'm asking these questions and here's my benefit, do this. So it was actually quite a challenge. But they did a sensational job of actually asking the questions to the claims. How did I know I get a question from you?
That's all right.
That's a pretty big room.
There's the intervention group, the control group, and then there's a whole other group, right, of people who are not asking any questions.
I wonder if there'll be any difference in results between the people who asked questions but weren't given a case management intervention versus people who didn't have the list of questions. Do you think there'll be any difference in claim outcomes for them?
Yeah, it's one of the challenges.
Knowing the information, I guess. Knowing the risks that they've elicited by asking more questions.
Oh, so... So you think that's, as in that's happened in both groups?
Between the control group,
yep.
And then the others.
Others. Yeah. Yeah, look, one of the challenges is that we would like that third arm for the analysis. One of the challenges is that we've kind of used up the source of similar claims with between the intervention and control groups. So there is a potential we might be able to use historical controls in terms of they haven't elicited that information to see and compare performance before asking the questions to after asking the questions. It was a real challenge even to identify the locations within EML to get suitable numbers to permit some of the analysis that we need to do. Because while it's great to have 560 total claims, you cut that in half and then you start looking at different injury types and all of a sudden your numbers get very small. So absolutely. But hopefully we'll get some indications of even asking those questions help the control group.
No? All right, well, thank you. Thanks, Ross. Thanks so very much.